Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. It's the end of the first phase, ladies and gentlemen. It's the beginning of the next chapter and we're all walking through it together, right? On Monday, we're appearing live from a pub to celebrate the opening of indoor hospitality and judging by the weather forecast, we're going to need plenty of shelter. This week, we've already opened Parliament, we've questioned the NHS policy on virtual GP consultations and we've revealed why mask wearing is to be no longer a thing. Today, we've got Pauline Latham MP on to talk about why the government might finally be learning how to deal with the COVID variant problem, as the Indian one has now popped up in Blackburn and Bolton. We'll also be asking her about the problem with seeing the doctor and why Labour is having such trouble trying to define what the party stands for, particularly in parts of the country which should be staunchly Labour. And now on 0344 499 1000. Coming up later on, we're joined by royal author Angela Levin, as the Herbert, formerly known as Prince, once more has thrown his family under a bus in the name of the almighty dollar and is increasingly to spill his guts to all and sundry about how awful his life has been. This time, it's in a podcast with former drug abuser and actor Dax Shepherd, who specialises in laying bare mindless celebrities who are all suffering and in pain despite their millionaire lifestyles and pampered jobs. What an absolutely disgusting specimen he has become. 0344 499 1000. Kevin O'Sullivan joins us as well with a look ahead to his big shows this weekend and a view on the ludicrous spectacle in Glasgow yesterday, where the Home Office was forced to release several illegal immigrants who were ordered to deport because of pressure from the local community and indeed from the Scottish Government. As ever, of course, we need to hear from you, your stories, your experiences and what you're hearing in your own communities. 0344 499 1000. And because it's Friday, it's time for the Perrier Awards. We've managed to persuade Yorkshire's finest, Izzy Rowland, to work more than 2 days this week. She'll be here with an homage to my brilliance in journalism. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, right here on the fastest growing radio station on the planet. It is, of course, Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, there's all sorts of stuff on the front pages this morning, but I have to say, even I was taken aback by the latest missive from the Herbert, formerly known as Prince Harry, who seems to think it's a great idea to go around telling everybody how terrible his life is, how awful it is living in the royal family, which he's now left, and how being in the Truman Show and the zoo is similar to actually living a pampered, privileged lifestyle with hot and cold running butlers, hot and cold running servants, hot and cold running housekeepers, hot and cold running chauffeurs, nannies and everything else, living in a mansion in Beverly Hills practically, moving to Montecito later on, and really just having the most privileged of lives, talking down to people as if he's trying to help them. He's making out that only he can feel the pain of torture and everything terrible that has happened to him. I'm sorry that his mother was killed. I'm sorry that he feels bad. I'm sorry that he thinks that he's got a worst of all worlds going on. But I'm afraid there are lots of people, ordinary people, who've suffered in the same way, who also have lost a parent, who also don't have multi-million pounds to fall back on, who don't have a multi-millionaire lifestyle, who don't have people waiting at the gates of their 16-room mansion to drive them to a restaurant where it doesn't matter how much money you spend on dinner because you've got so much you don't even know how much you have. It's absolutely disgusting what he's doing, throwing his entire family under a bus, basically saying that his father was a useless parent, basically saying the royal family are useless people. I think Harry is an absolute and utter disgrace. We'll be talking about that coming up later on. Let's kick off, though, first of all, with Pauline Latham, Conservative MP for Mid Derbyshire, because she has been a great advocate of the opening up of hospitality. Finally, on Monday, we're going to see that getting more back to normal. Pauline, a very good morning to you.
Morning.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. I'm not going to bother you with the Harry scenario because I'm so annoyed about it that I'm not quite sure I can keep my calm and keep my counsel. But he really needs to just button the lip, I think, would be a good piece of advice for him. Let's talk a little bit about Monday, because you've been a great advocate, as I say, of opening up the pubs, opening up hospitality, getting business back to normal. This is going to be a big day, isn't it?
It is, and I think that all the hospitality businesses are really looking forward to it. They still have to operate in a COVID-secure way, of course, but with the infections going down drastically and the deaths going down drastically, the NHS is not overwhelmed anymore. Even those people who get COVID are not being hospitalised in the ways that they were. So there's no reason why we shouldn't open up much quicker than we have done, but we are where we are. And so now the hospitality businesses have the opportunity to finally, after over a year, make some money to pay their overheads and pay their staff.
Yes, and to be able to really make some plans for the rest of the year, really, and even get the staff back from furlough. Because I was with a friend of mine on Wednesday in a restaurant, which is owned by a friend of mine. He got a call in the midst of our lunch to dismantle his entire outdoor kind of area because Kensington Council said that it didn't apply the right rules and the right regulations. And they said if he didn't take it all down, this was like Perspex screens, they would come around that afternoon and shut him down. I mean, we really need to make sure that the councils are not going to be too stupid about this stuff.
Well, we do. We've got to use a bit of common sense because all these businesses have really struggled. Some of them are actually struggling to get staff to come back because they've gone and got other jobs. So I think there's a huge number of problems for hospitality businesses still to overcome. The good thing about having outdoor space now with the better weather, hopefully, I mean, I know we've got some rain coming, but as the summer goes on, hopefully most businesses will have more space to be able to accommodate people who want to enjoy themselves outside. And therefore, they can make a better opportunity than they had before when they just really had indoor spaces. And some hospitality businesses have been incredibly creative about making very attractive outdoor spaces that can be used right the way through the summer as well as the indoor.
Yes, absolutely right. And very importantly, I've got this from Julia, who's a listener, saying the next month is essential to the survival of pubs and restaurants. If you book a table and then don't turn up without giving them notice of cancellation, then you are a very bad person indeed. I don't want to say what word she actually used. But, I mean, that is another thing that we want to encourage people not to do, don't we?
It's not fair because I actually think that the hospitality businesses ought to charge them. They ought to charge a deposit for a table.
Yes.
Because
well, some of them are doing that, which I mean, I wouldn't have been in favour of it before this, but I think in this instance, I think I would be.
I think until things get back to normal, we ought to be looking at doing that because it really is very unfair for people to go and book two or three places and then just decide on the spur of the moment which one they'll bother with because when there's limited space indoors, we have to make sure that it can be used and it can be productive, and therefore they're taking the money.
Mm. And what do you think is the likelihood that many of these restaurants will get back to normal, sort of in another month? Because obviously at the moment, from what I understand, they're told that they can open up inside, but they can't open up every single table inside. They can only open up sort of every second one.
I think it's like at this time, it's going back to where we were before the last lockdown, where you could book a table and you were COVID secure, you were separated and you had to have all table service. I hope, provided this Indian variant doesn't rear its ugly head, and I feel there's strategies we can put in place to stop that.
Yeah.
Provided that doesn't happen, I think that next time, in 5 weeks' time, we should be able to open up properly without any restrictions. After all, we've had the experiments in the football stadium, we've had the experiments at the awards earlier this week with no social distancing, no masks, and 4,000 people, I believe, on Monday night or Sunday night, whenever it was. And we need to look at what that evidence gives. Does it mean that there's a big spike? I mean, we were told there'd be a big spike with schools.
Which didn't happen,
right? There hasn't been. No, it didn't happen. So, you know, we've got to be sensible and not panic all the time and not say, oh, there might be a new variant. Yeah, there will be new variants, and new variants of flu every year. We deal with that. Now that so many of us are vaccinated, we shouldn't have the problem of overwhelming the health service, which is really what it's all been about.
Mm, absolutely right. And it does seem to me as though the government have kind of learned a little bit of a lesson, because listening sort of to the early part of yesterday around lunchtime, I was worried that there was going to be this kind of speech made at 5 o'clock by a minister to say, well, you know, the Indian variant seems to be coming up on the rails and we're going to have to postpone the opening of the hospitality business on Monday. Happily, they haven't done that. They've looked at the variant. They've sort of defined it, worked out that in places like Blackburn and Bolton, it's probably been brought in from India. It's probably circulating within the Asian community. And a lot of the people who are apparently infected with it are quite young. So there's no need to sort of, you know, necessarily panic, as you say, and shut everything else down.
Exactly. And I think they could, they're talking about going and vaccinating more people more quickly in those areas. That's probably the right thing to do, to go in and flood it with testing and vaccinations and get as many people so that there is herd immunity, which we talked about right at the beginning of the pandemic. And it seems to be a phrase that's gone out of the window now.
Yes.
But we need to do that wherever there is a new strain that they are concerned about. And I, you know, I understand why they're concerned, but we need to go and flood it and make sure that it isn't the problem that some scientists like to think it is.
Yes, absolutely right. And as far as the whole mask debate goes, I mean, clearly schools are going to be getting rid of them as of Monday.
Yes.
But I'm already hearing that from some individual school children, and also from my own kids, that there are some places still saying, well, we still recommend that you wear a mask. We still recommend that you wear it either in a corridor or in the classroom. You know, they're still not quite getting rid of the masks in school, because some of the schools are hanging on to the idea that they should be wearing them.
But we were told right at the beginning of the pandemic that the masks didn't work unless you change them regularly. And I don't see school children changing them regularly. Goodness knows what happens to them when they take them off at the end of the school day and stick them in their pocket and then stick them on the next day.
Mm.
Any germs that are on the inside will be on the outside. So, you know, I think it's had limited impact, because we were told by scientists you won't need to wear masks.
Mm.
And then suddenly we all have to do it.
Right.
But none of us do it properly. We all stick them in a handbag or in our pocket or put them on the table, which could be a way of spreading the germs. So I think if we can get rid of mask wearing, and certainly in schools, because I don't think it's a healthy environment for teachers to teach and pupils to learn, because there hasn't been the big spike. We've got primary schools where they don't wear them, the children don't wear them. There's been no big spike with no masks. So why are we insisting, or why are some people still insisting on wearing them?
No, quite. And it looks as though in June, on the 21st, that all mask wearing will be done away with in any event, aside from very possibly on public transport. And even then, I think people will take the view that, well, if you're not having to wear them basically out in shops, if you're not having to wear them in offices, then I'm just not going to wear one on public transport either.
Exactly. I mean, they say there's going to be a big fine if you don't wear them at the moment, but that should go. And, you know, provided that I can imagine some people will still want to wear them, and that's their choice.
Yeah, of course.
And I think that's absolutely
fine. Nobody would
argue
with that.
No, and we need to give freedom of choice back to people and not be such dictators.
Mm. Well, quite. Speaking of which, can we talk about the doctors? I've been having a bit of a campaign over the past 2 or 3 weeks, Pauline, about the idea that so few people are being able to get in to see their GP. And I know it's not all GPs. Many GPs are operating normally, but there's a massive problem. Alison Pearson's been writing about it in The Telegraph as well. And we've both been getting an awful lot of communication emails from people saying, this is outrageous. You know, I haven't seen a doctor for a year. Then now it turns out to be NHS guidance, which suggested that they should triage people without actually seeing them. They now seem to have reversed that after maybe some of the stink that we kicked up about it. But I mean, there's no excuse really, is there, for this kind of form of medicine?
I don't like it. Some people do prefer it because they don't have to sit in a waiting room or break off from what they're doing and they just get a phone call. Personally, I don't. And I actually think things will get missed, because sometimes I understand people will go in with one problem and then say just, oh, and by the way, I've got this. And the doctor will then suddenly pick up something serious. You don't do that on the phone. You deal with one issue, whatever you've said you're going to talk about. You don't have that chat, so there's no relationship with the doctor. It's not a personal relationship anymore. But what worries me is we're being told that rather than going to your GP first, 111 is where we should access first, rather than going to your GP. Well, what is the point of a GP then?
Exactly.
If you can go to 111, we might as well abolish all the GPs, go through 111, be triaged, go into the walk-in centre, and then either go to the hospital or go home with a prescription. And I feel that is the beginning of the breakdown of the NHS as we know it.
But is this something that's been ordered by Matt Hancock? I mean, is he aware of what is going on? Has he, in fact, suggested it? A lot of people have said to me that even before the pandemic was going on, they were having trouble getting in to see a doctor.
Yeah, I think there's a combination of things. Many more GPs are part-time rather than full-time.
Right.
So we train lots and lots and lots of doctors. But if they're only going to work part-time, we're not getting a full-time person there. So we may train 20,000, but actually we only get 10,000 worth of, I suppose I can't say man hours, person hours in that time.
Careful.
Might be accused of all sorts of things.
Yes.
But actually, if we're doing that, we need to train twice as many, because if you're not getting that personal relationship, you're not getting in to see a doctor, and it is all done on the phone. I seriously think quite a lot of things will be missing. But I understand some GPs think it's great, but it's twice as much work, because you ring up, there's a triage system, the doctor rings you back, you ring up, you queue for ages, they ring you back, to find out what's the matter with you, and some of the things they can't diagnose on the phone. So then you have to go in. So the doctor's got two points of contact, and I just feel that sometimes they're making a rod for their own back. And I know there are time wasters. In the health service, there are people who are the worried well that are always at the doctor's, but they should be able to weed those out and talk to those on the phone if they don't need to see them, because they're always in.
Yeah.
But there are some people, as you say, who haven't been to see a doctor for a year.
Of course.
And they should be going, because there's
possibly
something really wrong.
People who are, perhaps borderline hypochondriacs who constantly ring the doctor. I'm sorry, if you're a doctor, that's part of life. It's a bit like me saying, I don't want people ringing the radio station who might not be serious. Well, it's our job to deal with them, it's part of what we do. And we don't always put them on to air, because it might not be a great experience for everybody. But I'm afraid if you're a doctor and you're going to get phone calls from people, I'm afraid some of them might be frivolous and you're just going to have to deal with it. You need to sort of, at the risk of doing what you just did, man up or woman up and get on with it. Because, you're supposed to be providing a service to the community, and the community has paid for that service. It's not as if, you're somehow doing it out of the goodness of your heart. Doctors are paid very well. They make a pretty good living, a bit like farmers. I've never seen a poor doctor.
Well, and of course, MPs get people who are time wasters.
Yeah.
We get people that are just...
Sometimes they're other MPs.
Yes. but also we get people with serious problems that we deal with, but then we get the frivolous people, and we have to deal with those as well.
Yeah.
And it can be a pain, but it is all part of the job.
But exactly right. Finally, we must talk about the Labour Party, Pauline, who seem to be all over the place at sixes and sevens.
Yes.
They don't know what they're doing. They don't know who to put up as candidates. They seem to think that putting up a failed Remainer candidate from a previous constituency in Hartlepool was a great idea in the place where they voted the biggest ever as a constituency to leave the European Union. They're woke. Keir Starmer thinks it's all the fault of all the women that work for him. I mean, where are they going? Are they ever going to present any kind of problem for the Tory party ever again?
Well, I hope not, but that isn't actually good for democracy.
No.
But it used to be, the reason why they lost all the seats in Scotland was they took them for granted. They said, well, if you're Scottish, you'll vote Labour. We've now got the north of England. Well, if you live in the north, northeast particularly, you'll vote Labour.
Mm.
Well, they're not doing, and they're turning their back on the Labour Party, and they've got to come up with an idea of what they do stand for. It's sad to see the demise of a major political party, but it looks as if it's going down that route. And there's no competition from the Liberal Democrats either, because there's hardly any of those either. So I do believe that we need a credible opposition in Parliament. It's nice to think that they won't be there and we won't have one, but it really isn't good for the country. So we need a proper one. They've got to sort themselves out. Otherwise, they will die.
Yeah, no, I think so.
Will not vote for people that don't know what they want.
No, quite right too. Pauline, great to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Pauline Latham, Conservative MP for Mid Derbyshire, a great defender of democracy, a great defender as well of the pub culture in this country and of the hospitality culture in this country, which does, thankfully, finally get a bit more back to normal on Monday. We'll be doing a live show from the Horseshoe here in London once again, because we do support the industry. It's nothing to do with the fact that we all do like to go out and have a good time, which of course we do. But it is also about the fact that we support an industry which is worth billions of pounds, which provides millions of jobs, and which also collects huge amounts of revenue for the Treasury and for this government to spend on other things.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Right now, though, let's talk to Dr. Simon Clark, Associate Professor in Cellular Microbiology at Reading University. Simon, very good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
Delightful to be able to talk to you under circumstances which are seemingly slightly better even than the last time we spoke.
Always, yes. It's all moving in the right direction.
It really is, isn't it?
And also, it carries on doing that.
Yes, and also I'm quite encouraged. I was a bit worried yesterday when we started to hear noises about the Indian variant and that Matt Hancock was going to make a statement, and I was terrified that they were going to suddenly come out and go, no, we can't open the restrictions on Monday now because of this variant. They seem to have learned that, you know, pivot around the variant, deal with it, find out where it is, you know, go to those places and take measures in those places, which is what appears to be going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was tried, last autumn, but I think arguably it wasn't done properly. So that's why it didn't work then. And of course, we see what's happening with the Indian variant in India. So it's going to worry people. It's going to concern them. And that's why it needs to be addressed in this country properly.
Yes. I mean, my understanding of it is that there's a couple of clusters of it, notably in Blackburn and in Bolton, a couple of other places as well. Aylesbury, I think, has got a bit of it. But it seems to be affecting younger people as well. So that is not as alarming, I suppose, as if it was affecting older, you know, more vulnerable types.
That's right. And we want it to stay in younger people. We want to stamp it out completely, but it's better to be in younger people than in older people. It's probably there because they haven't been vaccinated, is my guess.
Yeah.
And also, the numbers we had yesterday, we were told, it's gone up over the past week or so. Actually, no, that's not true. That's not what that data tells us. That data is about 10 days, 2 weeks old by the time we get it, because it takes that long to generate it. We don't really know what it's done over the past couple of weeks, but we do know from that it is predominantly associated with travel, people arriving into this country, you know, a couple of weeks ago. And really, that's one thing. We don't want that, but that's better than it growing here organically and moving amongst the population.
Quite, yes. And I mean, I suppose we'll always be on the lookout for the next variant and the one after that. And I'm told there's hundreds of thousands of them. It's not just that there's only about 10 or 12. It just so happens that we only know of the ones that we've actually named. So there's kind of variants going on all the time, aren't there?
Indeed, there are. And we don't know the vast majority of them, because most of the world doesn't have the wherewithal to assess them and to sequence them and find out what's changed in them. So really, we only know a tiny sliver of what goes on around the world, even in some developed countries.
Yes. And looking around the world, Simon, I mean, what does it look like to you at the moment? Obviously, we know about India having a problem. I haven't really heard much about Brazil recently. I'm not sure how that's all going, or indeed Peru, which seems to have another lockdown. Germany seems to be coming out of the bad part of what they had a couple of months ago. Are you seeing a kind of easing of it, generally speaking?
No, I think South America has gone quiet. I don't know that it's eased necessarily, but without proper controls, without vaccination, even places that have eased will relapse into to further outbreaks. That's just the way these things go. They work in waves. My big concern next is Africa and what will happen there.
Yeah.
Because, of course, there's virtually no vaccination going on across most of Africa.
Well, I must admit, it was always very odd to me when I looked at, in the early days of the pandemic, the kind of the global map, if you like, of where most of the infections were. And there were none in India and there were none in Africa. And I thought to myself, well, that doesn't sound right. Surely that's only because they haven't actually tested anyone. And therefore, all of the big numbers were in Western Europe and in the United States of America, where all the testing was going on. So it's always difficult, isn't it, when you look at actual, you know, what are supposedly statistics without knowing what the facts are.
That's absolutely true. But of course, in India, and many parts of Africa as well. It's not just down to testing, because of course, if people had it and just weren't getting picked up in the testing, they'd still be turning up in hospital unable to breathe. That's of course what we see in India. So we don't have a real good handle on why that during the initial waves of the pandemic, certain parts of the country seemingly got off lightly. There will be lots of hypotheses and kites flown, but really that's all they are. They're just ideas at this stage. When people tell you they know the answer, never believe them. They never know the answer.
Well, unfortunately, many of them who don't know the answer have been helping to create government policy. And presumably, once the inquiry begins in the early part of next year, we might find out that some of the things that we did perhaps weren't all that necessary.
Oh, I'm sure we will. Absolutely. We will find out that some things were more effective than others. But, you know, we haven't had a pandemic in this country for about 100 years. And of course, circumstances were very different. The way people lived was very different back then. So, and indeed, I can't think of a pandemic in any other developed nation either for many decades.
No.
So how to handle it was largely guesswork.
And are you one of those people who thinks that some of the measures that were put into place will continue to stay? I mean, we're told that mask wearing will probably become something of an unusual act come June, at least maybe everywhere except for perhaps on public transport. But again, I mean, I will say, look, if you want to wear a mask, you know, go ahead, help yourself. You know, I don't mind if you want to wear a mask. I'd just rather you didn't tell me to have to wear one.
Well, I quite agree with that. I've no business telling anybody else how to dress, because frankly, I think that's all it really is.
Right.
I do think...
Well, do you remember how many times years and years ago you would see an awful lot of people coming here from, say, Asia, from Japan and from China, and they would be wearing masks on the underground, and you think that's a bit weird. But that's what their culture is. And so you wouldn't go up to them and go, take that off. You just let them do it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's entirely up to them.
Yeah.
But it wasn't that long ago that you weren't allowed to cover your face going into a bank, for example. That will become commonplace, I suspect, now over the next few years. Mm. I've never been an advocate of masks, other than the fact we were told to wear them, so wear them. But, you know, the evidence for their use and the evidence for their effectiveness still is flimsy at best. Mm. So I would argue that should be one of the first things to go.
Yeah. But, of course, you know, if you'd said that to me about 4 months ago, all hell would have kicked off. You had, you know, Neil O'Brien on your case calling you a COVID denier, telling you that you were somehow encouraging people to kill other people. I mean, I've never seen anything like the propaganda machine that the government's wheeled out for all this.
Oh, I for masks, tell me about it. I was arguing against them a year ago.
Yeah.
And I've had all manner of abuse. But the ultimate response is show me the evidence and I'll change my mind. Because I always will if you show me the proper evidence. Because that's what scientists do. They do not dig themselves into positions and insist on staying there.
Yeah. And do you think, Simon, that we are, you know, probably not likely to see the like of this again, certainly in our kind of, well, perhaps certainly not in my lifetime anyway, but how about yours? You're a bit younger than me.
I have to say that there could well be another coronavirus epidemic or pandemic in the not-too-distant future. We've had three in the past 20 years. Mm. This is the big one. SARS certainly could have got bigger, but didn't transmit quite so easily. So these things are coming out of the woodwork, if I can put it like that, relatively quickly. So there is the possibility. But of course, the next one might be relatively mild. We simply don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I would feel happier if I felt like I knew a bit more about how it started, because I still don't really know anyone that can tell us that, because we've seen the World Health Organization going into China, doing a little bit of a sort of investigation, which didn't really come to much at all. Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's no point. I mean, I could ask you what you think had started it, but, you know, your guess is as good as mine. But shouldn't we know more about where it came from in order to prevent it from happening again?
Yeah, I think we should. I mean, it's for that reason, and it's an interesting, for someone like me, an interesting academic question. But we really do need to know how these things arrive in the human population. And I don't mean just saying, oh, they come from animals. That's almost certainly true. But exactly what makes them come from animals to humans? I mean, I'm quite happy to believe that that it was humans eating animals that carried the virus. I would be quite happy to believe that it was an accidental escape from a laboratory. I don't buy the stuff about it being a biological warfare program.
No.
Because if it was, the Chinese would have made a better vaccine.
Yes.
But, mistakes do happen. And things
also,
like that
if you're going to make... It seems to me, if you're going to make a biological weapon, you would rather make one that actually kills people rather than just kills some people, wouldn't you?
Exactly. That is what you would do, yes. Yeah. Rather than just old people.
Just one that kills a lot of old people in hospitals and care homes. It's not much of a biological weapon, to be honest.
Not really, no.
But listen, as I say, great that we are getting to where we want to be faster than perhaps we would have hoped. And good that we've got next week to go inside, because apparently it's going to be raining all week. So if you did want to go to the pub, you wouldn't want to be sitting outside it. So have a good weekend, Simon. We'll talk to you soon. Dr. Simon Clark, Associate Professor in Cellular Microbiology at Reading University.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Should we have a listen to what Prince Harry said to Dax Shepherd on his Armchair Expert podcast?
There's no blame.
Yeah.
I don't think we should be pointing the finger or blaming anybody. But certainly when it comes to parenting, if I've experienced some form of pain or suffering because of the pain or suffering that perhaps my father or my parents had suffered, I'm going to make sure that I break that cycle so that I don't pass it on, basically. There's a lot of genetic pain and suffering that gets passed on anyway.
Yeah, and the
we as parents, we should be doing the most that we can to try and say, you know what, that happened to me, I'm going to make sure that doesn't happen to you.
Yeah. It's hard to do because some of it's so just
it's really hard to do, but for me it comes down to awareness. Like,
yeah.
I never saw it, I never knew about it, and then suddenly I started to piece it all together and go, okay, so this is where he went to school. This is what happened. I know this bit about his life. I also know that's connected to his parents.
Yeah.
So that means that he's treating me the way that he was treated.
Exactly.
Which means, how can I change that for my own kids? And, well, here I am. I've now moved my whole family to the US. Well, that wasn't the plan. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
But sometimes you've got to make decisions and put your family first and put your mental health first.
Do shut up, Harry. Just shut it. Let's talk to Angela Levin. Hello, Angela.
Hello, good morning.
God almighty. I mean, where does it end? He says he feels like he's not blaming anybody. Then he launches into a huge blame game for his father because of where he went to school and because of the way he was treated and because of the way he treated his son and how he now has to stop being the same with his own child. I mean, you know, it's unbelievable, this, isn't it?
Well, we've often seen him say one thing and then change his mind, and this is a perfect example. Mm. I don't want to blame anyone, but I am blaming...
Yeah, but here's who I'm blaming.
My father, my grandmother, and my late grandfather.
Yes.
I mean, he's only been dead just over a month.
Yeah.
It's just appalling when he knows that his other close relatives are grieving. And also this genetic pain, it's a very sort of woke word, isn't it? Woke phrase.
Oh, yeah.
I've never come across a perfect parent. I think you're lucky if you've failed by a small amount. I don't think there is such a thing. He's coming up with something that any sane person would know by the time they were in their mid-30s.
I mean, this is the point, right?
You learn from that. Yeah, you think, I don't want to do that. But you don't have to try and crush them. You don't have to spread this nasty washing royal dirty linen in front of thousands, if not millions. Yeah. He's got no perspective on what somebody else might feel.
No.
He's
a complete and utter narcissist, Angela, isn't he?
Well, I don't like to give people titles. I just like to...
Well, he doesn't like them either, apparently.
I think about them, which is probably worse. But it's a nonsense. Every generation has a different view because they've been brought up differently, and they do that with their children. But I must say that poor old Archie, if they're never going to let him see his father's family and never have... get in touch with them when he grows up, he might be absolutely furious with his father for depriving him of that wonderful feeling of family and love and warmth. So, you know, we can all do it wrong, but for him to stand there and start then pouring out, I am a victim, I've been treated so badly, full of self-pity, it's terrible. One thing that's very interesting is that he claims in this interview that Meghan was the one to persuade him to seek mental health help.
Right.
When I interviewed him at considerable length in Kensington Palace in 1917, he was going out with Meghan, but they weren't engaged. And I
you mean
said,
2017? I assume, right? 2017.
Did Meghan? 2017, sorry, yeah.
I mean, you know, I know you're good, Angela, you're not that good.
I said to him, did Meghan advise you to do that? Did she help you? Because I know she's very interested in all these things. He said, absolutely not. She had absolutely nothing to do with it. It was William. He told me that I should go and seek help because of all the things that I was suffering, panic attacks and losing his temper very quickly. And he said, at first I didn't listen because who listens to their older brother? And I felt the time wasn't right. But in the end I did, and I'm incredibly grateful to him. William.
Yeah, now, but I mean, this is the problem, Angela, for me with this guy is that he's now a liar, actually. Because in addition to that, right, that's the first lie. The other lie was the one that they told about the fact that, you know, when Meghan was at Kensington Palace, she couldn't get any mental health help because when she needed it, nobody wanted to talk to her. Nobody wanted to recommend it anyone, which is clearly an absolute and utter lie.
Well, Harry said he was ashamed and he didn't know who to go to. Yeah. Well, he could have just called up his own a specialist. But also, you know, women when they're near 40, when they see their gynaecologist every month, the gynecologist asks, you know, because women can feel very depressed about pregnancy. They don't like their shape. They're uncomfortable. And she could have said to them, look, I'm feeling depressed. So it's very, very hard to believe.
I think that's the problem here. And also this nonsense that he talks about, that he feels as if he's living in the Truman Show or that, you know, being in the royal family is a bit like being in a zoo when everybody's staring at you. It's nothing like that. That's not true. Because members of the royal family have a duty to do certain events. They have a duty to do certain things in public. But they also have a great deal of a private life. It's not as if there's a camera on them all the time. And the reason why he might feel like that now is because there is a camera on him all the time, because he's invited the cameras in.
Yes, exactly. Now, none of us have discovered where he went on honeymoon. Mm. So that is one example of how nobody set out to try and find them. And he had a lot of space. He went on lots of holidays with Meghan where nobody tried to find him.
Right.
But now they're pushing themselves forward in every possible opportunity to earn money or just to make the headlines in the papers, which they're doing very successfully. And saying they were in a zoo. He did say he felt he was in a goldfish bowl. And I think one should agree that it is tough being in the royal family, but the advantages and the ways you can get through to anyone at the top of any issue you want to know, whether it's the army or whether it's mental health, they're there for you. It's a huge privilege.
Yes. It really is. And I mean, yeah. I'm sure that it can be difficult to be in the public eye. I'm sure it can be awful to every time you go out, be recognised, to have people wanting to shake you by the hand or to take your picture or even maybe to do something worse than that. But, you know, as you say, there are, you know, perks as well. I mean, Bob has sent me this tweet earlier on today who said, Harry lost his mum in a car accident. He had the security of wealth, a father, a family and international love. At 13, I lost my mum and dad in a car accident. I had no wealth, no family, no love. Hapless Harry needs to grow a pair. You know, he's not the only person that's lost a parent.
Yes, but he also lost her a long time ago. And if you compare him to William, who also lost the same mother a long time ago, he's tried to make something positive out of it. Harry is absolutely set on using it to abuse his own family.
I know.
And it doesn't make sense. He could have left the royal family without titles, without anything, and gone quietly to live in Africa and looked after animals, which is what he told me he wanted to do. But instead of which, they've gone to a hothouse and they're employing 12 people to keep their whatever they do in the front pages. Well, it would drive you mad. In any other form.
Well, yeah, I mean, he reveals...
doing that because he's a prince.
He reveals in this interview that he's mates with Orlando Bloom, you know, like that bloke who likes to kneel on paddle boards completely naked, showing off the crown jewels, if you like. And apparently they exchange information about where the paparazzi are, right? Well, guess what? The paparazzi happened to be in California. That's where it was invented. You know, there's no paparazzi on Vancouver Island. There's no paparazzi if you wanted to go into the depths of the Republic of Congo and look after the gorillas. You know, you won't find too many paparazzi there. If you want to avoid the paparazzi, I would suggest don't go and live in California.
Yes, absolutely. But Meghan comes up with this quite a spiteful comment as well, saying that he's got sort of no gratitude. You know, you don't need to be a princess. You can create a much better life without being a princess. Mm. But it's actually being a duchess or a princess that's given her the opportunity to earn pots of money, to live in a house with 16 bathrooms and to be recognised throughout the world. So all that is actually... so hypocritical, but it makes you feel quite ill sometimes.
It really does. I mean, she would not be anyone. I mean, she would not be getting deals with Netflix and Spotify and doing podcasts all over the place if she was simply Meghan Markle, the former Suits star, because nobody had heard of her, really. You know, she might have had a reasonable income. She might have had a reasonable career. But, I mean, you know, we all know that despite the fact that that Harry was trying to pimp her out to the Disney chief when they were at a do in London, you know, she's not exactly in great demand in Hollywood in the studios because she's not a very good actress at the end of the day. And what about the time he said that, you know, my family are the family that Meghan never had? Do you remember when he said that?
Yes, he said that for Christmas, the first Christmas she was here, when she wasn't engaged to him and the Queen said she could come, which she didn't allow Kate to come before she was engaged or Camilla. So she was very strict protocol there.
Yeah.
But Harry begged her to let Meghan come and she came. So, and also how Prince Charles behaved at the wedding when he walked Meghan halfway up the aisle and tried to sort of disappear to leave her in the spotlight, all that. But what they feel now is that what's happened to them has given them the right to control the world, to heal the world, and to come out with ludicrous things like be compassionate to those you know and those you don't know. Well, they're not compassionate to those they know.
No.
It's part of their family. Not in the slightest.
No. And now they've done a deal with Procter & Gamble. The fee for which is undisclosed, it would seem clear to me that that's not a charitable venture, because otherwise why wouldn't they disclose how much money is going to the charity? But they've done a deal with Procter & Gamble, one of the probably most global organisations you could ever wish to find, an organisation which makes an awful lot of beauty products, which are blamed for polluting the oceans, which are blamed for deforesting the forests of the world, and which are blamed for all manner of ghastliness, because they're you know, an international trading company dealing in things that are commercial, you know. So I don't know where's their kind of green agenda gone.
Yeah, well, they're worth £47 billion, the company, but they have been accused of using child labour and also sticking on prices that you can't change,
right,
which is also illegal on, right, on their goods. So it seems Meghan is going to advise them how to be more compassionate and caring. What's she going to do? Sit in meetings with this CEO? Doesn't make sense. And she's saying what she wants is for young girls to be listened to and voice heard. That's another favourite expression. And sit where decisions are being made. Well, most of those girls will be at school. And also, you're not going to sit there waiting for a young teenager to tell you what to do with your company. So it's all sort of in a fog. You don't really, you can't really see what's ahead. You don't really know. Like the book, when they haven't really confirmed how much Meghan is going to get, they've agreed to give only 1% to charity, which is pretty poor. And perhaps all the money from Procter & Gamble will go into their accounts, and they could have another few bathrooms added to their home.
Well, listen, I mean, you can never have enough bathrooms. You know, if you've only got 9, you might be struggling, you know. But here's the thing. Or is it 9 bedrooms? I think it's 16 bathrooms, actually. I think it's something like that. But, you know, yeah, I just find it extraordinary that they're so kind of day class A, for want of a better word. They're so gauche. They're so kind of money-grabbing and horribly kind of vacuous. And they think that anybody cares. You know, he keeps saying in this piece that he's done with this podcaster that, you know, he's doing it for everybody else's benefit. You know, he doesn't feel like he's moaning. He feels like he's helping people. Well, who's he helping exactly?
Yes. Well, I think the problem is you don't want to help people by making them feel negative, do you?
No, I wouldn't have thought so.
I mean, what you want to do, if people come from a very dysfunctional home, which indeed he did, you want to say, look, I did, and I've done this, 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 and I feel better and I'm happier and we can get over it. That's the way to help people, not to be there grumbling about something you can't change. There's no point going on and on about something you can't change. And you can't change how your parents brought you up.
Yes.
You can change how you bring up somebody, but we don't really know that. It was all vacuous about, you know, he wants to break the chain, but how is he going to do it? You know, that would be more interesting.
Well, I mean, I'm going to happily hold my hands up and say that I was entirely wrong. I thought after the Oprah interview that there wasn't much more they could do. I was like, you know, he spilled his guts. They've given everything they've got to give. But he just keeps going on and on and on. And you think, when is it going to stop?
More. I think there's a lot more. I think there's another documentary in the making where they will...
The waking might be the right way to call it.
Where they will have taken film of various rooms and maybe even of various conversations, and they can then go detail by detail about how terrible certain things were. And I'm waiting for that one, and I think it will be yet another nail in the coffin of his relationship with his father and his brother. I mean, the point is you can't trust him even.
No.
Because if they say something, he passes it on to Meghan. It can't be Meghan because she wasn't there at the memorial service for the Duke of Edinburgh. And then it comes out in social media. Well, mending, repairing what goes on in a family is tricky. You can't just be there. And he says, especially at the funeral of his grandfather, I want this. And they say, yep, fine, off you go. It's got to be negotiated. And if you're telling facts all the time, leaking, you can't be trusted. So there's no point in going ahead with it, because how can you trust somebody who's going to spill the beans all the time?
Exactly. And I've just been sent, and I don't know if you've, I'm sure you have seen this, but it's from back, I think, in 2013, where she did a Men's Health magazine shoot where she was grilling hamburgers in some very short shorts, lots of, you know, finger licking and lots of kind of, you know, sultry poses. And I mean, it shows you really that this is not a woman who has ever been in any way demure, which is fine. You know, she can be whatever kind of woman she wants. But, you know, this kind of princess thing that she now does is completely and utterly against what she used to do, which was obviously anything to be famous.
Well, it's a cross between a princess and a nun, I think. You know, it's sort of purism. But I think the worst one was when she gave an interview when she was still doing Suits, where she wore something that was low on top, high on the bottom, open all over the place, and she was wriggling, and she was being interviewed by the presenter who didn't know where to look.
Right.
But she was just so provocative, incredibly sexy.
Yeah.
that that was how she wanted and chose to be interviewed.
Yeah.
Well, she obviously wouldn't do that now, and she was younger, but you know, her son might find that and say to her, how on earth could you look like that? You know, you do things, it might be mistakes, it might be to help you climb up the slippery slope of acting. We all do that and regret things, but it's important to analyze them, get rid of them and move on.
But that's the point. It's the hypocrisy that people object to. I think many people for a very long time felt very sorry for Harry. People respected him. He'd gone and done his duty out in Afghanistan. You know, he'd come back. Everybody knew that he had suffered because he was the younger son of Princess Diana when she died and all of that. But he's just ruined all of that now. I mean, there is nobody now that has any sympathy with him whatsoever in this country because they see him talking about how important it is that he looks after his own family while he consistently trashes his own family.
Yes. Well, I would really, really liked Harry when I spent the year with him. He was charismatic and fun and witty and loads of positive things. But you could see there was a dark side now and then, but just the dark side. But it seems to me, obviously he hasn't, but the impression it gives is he's had a brain transplant. Mm. And you can't recognise him. I just can't recognise
him. Well, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day and he was saying, you know, it's almost like she's got him under some kind of spell. You know, he literally can't speak without getting permission from her. Everything he says sounds as though she would have said it. You know, everything he does seems to be something that she would suggest that he does. And he doesn't seem to have any free will anymore.
Yes. Well, I think that the comment that I just made about you didn't need to be a princess, you know, you could have a much better life than a princess, was yet another way of saying, oh, this family are useless, you know, follow me. Mm. And also about the wedding, when she said it was just an event, you know, she wanted something more authentic, which is why she got married 3 days before, except she didn't. Mm. So she's knocking them in every which way, which is very cruel. And Harry seems to think that whatever she says is God, and that you must listen and you must obey. And that's what he's doing. In this talk that he gave, what was very interesting, he said he could never run on the beach and kick a football around with his dog. He could never do this, he could never do that. But he didn't really talk about them as a family or about Archie. It was just that, you know, every second he was under the spotlight. And when he comes to say what he wants to do, it's a nonsense to say that someone would follow him onto the beach every single time.
Well, wasn't he shortly thereafter pictured on the beach with a dog?
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
So, I mean, that's the end of that conversation, isn't it? You know, I can't do this. Well, you are doing it. So what's the problem? And there's a lot more famous people in Hollywood than he is, you know?
Yes. Well, the thing is about Hollywood, isn't it, that people are number one and then the next day they can be number zero minus 20.
Yeah.
You know, And I think if they keep on just moaning and groaning when, as you say, people who contact you have had very difficult lives and are struggling and yet are still trying to look on the positive side of life, people are going to get fed up.
Yeah, they really are.
I don't understand how Americans like to let it all hang out. It's very un-British.
It is very un-British. And I think that's the heart of the problem as well, because people say, you know, don't like Meghan Markle because she's black. Absolute rubbish. We don't like her because she's an American. It's as simple as that. And she's too American, and very embarrassing.
I don't even mind if she's American. I don't mind she's divorced. I don't mind anything. But I do mind that if you get what you want, you should shut up and not be very, very rude to the people who've given it to you. That's what I mind.
Yes.
The lack of manners.
Exactly
the
right.
The lack of doing something in the right way. That's what makes me incredibly angry, because I don't think anyone deserves it, especially as the senior royals can't respond. They can't say anything on their behalf.
No.
And they both know that. And I think that is grotesque, actually.
Well, it's absolutely right. Angela, great to talk to you again, as ever. I'm sorry it's about such a dreadful subject. Angela Levin, royal biographer, of course. Here's Prince Harry. Imagine waking up to this if you're in the royal family. Harry's bitter swipe at Charles. Dad passed his pain on to me. I will not do that to my kids. Really? But you don't mind doing it to your parents or your grandparents. You don't mind doing it to your boy's grandparents. You don't mind doing it to his great-grandparents. It's absolutely disgraceful, in my view. Prince Harry, mate, get a life. This is Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Ian Collins will be here shortly before 1 o'clock to tell us what's coming up on his show. But let us, without further ado, talk to Wendy Gregory, I should say, who's a psychologist, who's going to walk us through the dilemma, really, of being a working mother. Wendy, very good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Mike.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. I've got 4 children of my own. I like to think I know a little bit about what mothers go through, but being a bloke, of course, I would say that, wouldn't I? But it's really difficult, I think, for an awful lot of women. And Paloma Faith has kind of illustrated it quite well, I think, today.
Okay. I've got various thoughts on this, Mike, and far be it from me to tell Paloma or any woman what she should or shouldn't do. You know, that's really not what it's about. But I do have some concerns about what Paloma said. She does appear to be quite conflicted, and that's quite normal for mothers. But you know, on the one hand, she's saying how she feels so guilty about going back to work, and yet a few months ago, she actually said looking after a baby is much harder than going to work, and I would actually rather be at work. So you know, she's a little bit conflicted there about her motivation. And as you said, you know, lots of mothers do go back to work, but for most, the reason is financial, and they have no choice, and you know, that can't be helped. I don't think Paloma's in quite that situation, so this isn't a choice of hers.
No, that's right. I mean, I suppose if you're an international singing sensation, as we used to say in the tabloids, you know, you've got a slightly different set of priorities that you have to fulfil, right?
Yes, yes. And I think also my concern is she said that really her main fear is of losing her career. And she talked about it as a fear of death, the death of her career. That kind of concerns me. And again, I'm not wishing to judge her. But the thing is, having a child, as you will know, Mike, I have 2 myself. They're mercifully adult now. Well, that's over and done.
Yeah, but it never is. That's the trouble, is it?
No, it never is.
I mean, my oldest daughter is 31. She's currently in Lebanon, and I'm watching the news every night going, for God's sake, why do you have to be in Lebanon? Can you not go somewhere that's a bit safer, you know?
Of course, of course. But they do become more independent.
Yeah.
But really, I mean, this sounds like a cliche, but actually raising a child is the most important job you will ever do. And you know, careers can be revived. I mean, Dido's a good example. She gave up 10 years because she wanted to raise her children, and now she's reviving her career. So you can revive a career, but you can't give a childhood back. It's done, it's done. There's no going back. And that slightly concerns me about her motivation.
Sure. But you're right to say that, you know, all of these singers and sort of, you know, celebrities are slightly different to the rest of us because they do have a lot more money and they probably have a lot more choice as well. Because if you're in a sort of regular job, it's not so easy necessarily to go back. And I mean, I've known many women who have said, you know, it was a real struggle because they were becoming quite successful, especially in the media, for example. But then they decided to go away and have some children. And, you know, if you do that, you do kind of put a block on your promotional aspects and on the ability to go further than you were at the time when you left. When you come back, often you're coming back into a slightly less important job than the one you had before. And I think there's still a bit of a sort of prejudice against women in the workplace in that way.
There is. Absolutely there is. I mean, legally, there shouldn't be.
No, of course not.
But there is. And it, as you know, it's rarely the same for men unless they have the sole parent.
Yeah.
But as you said, it is difficult. We've got all these pressures on us as women. But I would still maintain that, you have to make a choice. Ultimately, there's a choice. Which do you put first? Your career prospects or your child's childhood? And I keep saying I don't want to be judgmental. It sounds as if I am. But I am actually basing this on the research and the facts, Mike. We've known about attachment theory for over 60 years now, when John Bowlby did his famous studies on attachment. And babies have a primary attachment figure from the second they're born. And it is usually the mother, because the mother feeds them, and not always, but almost always. And when they're apart from the mother, they do suffer separation anxiety. Yeah. And because they can't talk, we often don't realise that that's what they're suffering from. But they do. And it does actually set up quite a worrying neural network in the brain. And it can actually affect their attachments lifelong.
Yes.
Now, I know that may sound a little dramatic, but I was glad to see that Paloma is going to take the baby on tour with her. At least she's doing that.
Yeah.
But my concern, all this concern is about the baby. My concern is actually more for her older daughter, who is four and who will actually be starting school at the same time her mum goes away on tour. Now, she's going to miss her mum so much. She really is. And it's not as if Paloma's just going to the office and coming back in the evening. She's going to, I don't know how long the tour is, probably 6 months or something.
Yeah.
You know, she's going to be away for months and months and months. And that isn't the same for the average woman. You know, the average woman will go to work and come home and at least see their child every day. Yeah,
and I think that's really important, as you say. I mean, also, she did say that she suffered from postpartum depression after the birth of her first daughter. So, I mean, I suppose she's got some form here, which is probably not quite the right way to say it. But, you know, she clearly, like a lot of women, I think, don't quite realise how big of a deal it is to have a child. And I think that's also an issue that a lot of women go, oh, I think I'll have a baby now. And then they have a baby and they go, blimey, I had no idea it was going to be this difficult.
Wasn't expecting that.
Yeah.
No, you're right. And sometimes in that situation, maybe it is better for the mum to go back to work, you know, if the alternative is being depressed. Because babies are actually quite sensitive to their mother's feelings, and they do react when the mother is depressed. You know, it can affect their bonding process with the baby.
Yeah. What about the attitudes of men nowadays? Because, I mean, funnily enough, we were just talking about the old, that funny story, well, not really funny, but bizarre story about the train announcement that they had to apologise for because they said, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and it upset somebody who was non-binary, you know, and we're all supposed to be now much more aware of other people's, you know, feelings and much more aware of other people's priorities. But it's still I think the workplace is still quite sexist, really.
It is, and without doubt, absolutely without doubt. Some workplaces are worse than others. I think traditional male occupations like the police and the fire service and that, you know, those sorts of jobs which have been male-dominated, the stock market and so on, are still they are inherently sexist, absolutely. And I could bang on about this for hours, but I won't.
No, you can, because, I mean, I think it's quite an important thing, because I think for a lot of young women, you know, they do have to make that choice, which men still don't have to make. And it might not be anything to do with the workplace. It might just be to do with what I would regard as, you know, what you might call sort of traditional gender roles, you know, that men, because they don't give birth, God forbid, you know, we'd never have a human race. They'd all have, you know, it'd be too painful. We'd never bother doing it, you know.
But they'd never have more than one.
No, you just, you know, because we'd remember what it felt like to have one, whereas women seem to forget and go, oh, I think I'll have another one now. But, you know, it is, you know, I've never had to make a choice about whether to have a baby or not, you know, whereas, you know, the mother of my children has had to make that choice and she has had to decide. And it's, so it's not really fair. It never will be fair, will it?
Well, I don't know. I would question that because I think Britain is particularly entrenched in those sexist attitudes. There are other countries where it seems to work a lot better.
Really?
In some of the Scandinavian countries, for example, the mother has a year maternity leave and then the father has a year's paternity leave.
That's kind of, to me, you see, I feel that that's kind of lip service, right, to have paternity leave just because your wife or your partner has had a baby. You still don't have to do it. You still don't, you know, you're not forced into it, if you like. You can opt to do it, and then many companies will let you do it, but it's not the same, in my view, as a woman who has to say, right, I'm now going to get pregnant, I'm going to work for a while until the bump gets to the point where I'm going to stop working, and then I might come back, depending on whether they'll have me back, but I probably won't do the same job.
Yeah. No, you're right. But it's a step. It's a step in the right direction. I mean, even paternity leave, we didn't have here a few years ago.
Yeah.
And we do now, although it seems very limited. But I think attitudes are slowly, slowly changing. And more men do actually want to be hands-on with their babies. Obviously, they can't breastfeed, but they do want to be hands-on and change.
Yeah, but you could feed them and do all that. I mean, I did all that. But I mean, I took 2 weeks off, I think, when one of my kids was born. And after the first week, I was kind of surplus to requirements. And basically, we all just went, why don't you just go back to work? Stop hanging around. So I went back to work, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure what the solution is, Mike. Do you have a solution? What do you think should be done?
All I can say, and I mean, you might get a different argument from people with whom I've had children. But I mean, I would say, look, you just have to be as good of a parent as you can be, which is not just about being around when they're young, but it's about being around all the time. And it's about being around, particularly actually when they become teenagers, mm-hmm. when they start to get into interesting situations that you have to start treating them and talking to them like grown-ups and telling them about the world. And you have to prepare them is all I do for the rest of their lives, and hopefully raise, you know, children who are reasonably robust, reasonably kind of capable, and you never put expectations on them that they shouldn't have to fulfill.
Absolutely. It's about building their resilience
so
they can actually cope with life as independent.
And I mean, funnily enough, we're at the end of Mental Health Awareness Week, which I wasn't planning to talk to you about, but here we're also at the end of a period of time when we've all been locked down. It's been a very odd year, I think, particularly for teenagers. You know, I've got two teenagers who are kind of, you know, okay, but you know, it's been really difficult, I think, for them.
Absolutely. I think it's been worse for young people than for anybody else during the pandemic. Well, not anybody, that's not fair to say. People in care homes have had it pretty rough as well. However, that's reflected in the mental health statistics. The experience of anxiety and depression has risen right across the country, but most of all in 18 to 24-year-olds.
Yeah, I mean, I was listening to a story this morning on this station, I think, where people were saying that they're quite anxious. Some people are quite anxious about getting back out there, you know, like if they haven't been dating anyone for a long time because of the pandemic, or if they haven't really been in the workplace for a while, and now they're going to go back to an office and have to. Because you do. I mean, I tell this story that when I stayed away from my kids and their mother the first sort of lockdown, because I was in London, I was working, we weren't sure how dangerous everything was, and they're out of London, and I didn't go there for about 8 weeks. And when I did go back, it was quite weird. You know, we sat in the garden sort of looking at each other after the first hour, kind of going, what do we do now? You know, we've had lunch, we've had a bit of a chat, and I went for a nap. It was kind of, you know, because everyone was sort of looking at each other, not quite sure what to do.
Yes. It's interesting. I mean, I think one of the positives, and there are a few, but one of the positives that has come out of the pandemic, a lot of young people are saying, because I work a lot with young people, are saying to me they've got closer to their parents because parents have actually had to talk to them. Mm. And I know that sounds bizarre, but I've always said, you know, it's not about showering your children with expensive gifts. It's not about taking them to amazing theme parks. It's about just being available.
Yeah.
So if they want to talk to you, you're there.
Yes. And I think an awful lot of those kinds of distractions have been taken away, you know, because you couldn't go to Thorpe Park, you know, you couldn't go on holiday, you couldn't, you know, jump on a plane and go, let's go here and sit by a swimming pool. You know, you couldn't do any of that. So you actually were forced into, I suppose, interaction.
Absolutely. And it is one of my absolute bugbears is how many young mothers have a baby in a buggy. I don't know what they're taking them for a walk, but mum is actually on the mobile phone and not talking to the child. Right. And I feel like shouting at them.
I know. Get
talk
off the
to
phone.
Your baby. Talk
I
to
know.
Your baby.
Absolutely right. But that's the other thing about mask wearing and all that, you know, where I've been told by some mothers that they've had to go to, say, mother and baby groups, but they've all had to wear a mask. And you're thinking, what's the baby going to make of that? You know, they need to see your face.
They do need to see your face. Babies, even newborn babies, can read an enormous amount from their mother's face.
Yeah.
Apparently, when mothers are depressed, and it's not obviously not the mother's fault, because you tend to have a flat facial expression when you're depressed, and babies react to it. Even newborn babies, they can read it.
Yeah.
So it is important.
Well, I used to spend hours looking at every baby that I had, really, because they do something different every time you look at them. You know, it's great, isn't it? Because you go, day three, they're doing something else, and day four, they're doing something else. You know, it just goes on and on.
It does, and it is hard work. No one's doubting that, but it's also, I think it's an honour and a privilege. It really is,
and I think people should look upon it that way, because, I mean, we hear all the time, and I don't want to turn this into a kind of a, you know, a sort of a moan fest, but, you know, so many children do not get advantages in life. So many children don't get encouraged to do anything. You know, so many of them are raised wrongly. And I mean, it's not for me to say, I suppose, but, you know, you just think it's not that difficult, you know, just put some effort in.
Well, let me tell you a little anecdote, Mike. This was a 14-year-old girl, and she said to me that she remembers the time when she was, I don't know, I think eight, and she broke her leg. There were six children, so she had five siblings. And she said, it was the best day of my life because I got my mum's sole attention for 4 hours.
Wow.
She had to take me to hospital. And how sad is that?
I know.
That's saddened me so much. And I know if you've got six kids, it's hard to give any of them sole attention. But if you can, it is terribly important from birth onwards to give them your attention, to be available to them. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Well, maybe Paloma Faith listening and she'll take the 4-year-old with her on tour as well.
That's what I would do.
I'd take the 4-year-old with you, you know, and just say, well, you can be you know, schooled on tour. I'm sure it wouldn't do her any harm.
Well, yes. And some
put her in the band.
Thinking workplaces have creches, so mothers can actually take their children.
Yeah,
to work,
absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, delightful to talk to you, Wendy. Thank you very much indeed. Hope we weren't too judgmental for you. Wendy Gregory, psychologist there, talking about the importance of being a parent and the importance of actually being a proper parent. It doesn't mean that you don't have to be there all the time. But when you are there, just be with them is all I would say. How about this from Mark, the NHS Somerset trucker? Mike, it pains me to say this as I was a Grenadier Guardsman for 8 years and I'm a very pro-royalist, but I'm now absolutely done with Harry. My oath of allegiance never expires, but I'd never put my life on the line for Harry again. Isn't that a terrible indictment of what Harry has turned into and what he has become? And even his friends and old colleagues from the military have basically given up on him because he's just turned into a bit of a disgrace, to be honest. This is Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Now, just before we do what we always do at this time on a Friday, a little bit of breaking news for you. The Portuguese Minister of State for Foreign Affairs has announced today that British tourists will be allowed to enter Portugal as of midnight on the 17th of May, which, of course, is Monday. So that means if you want to go to Portugal, there was some doubt earlier on that you might not be able to. Now it's apparently true that you can. Travel restrictions in place, of course, until the 16th, until Sunday. But midnight on Sunday, basically, you're off. You're away. We'll be in a pub. Not in Portugal, but we maybe have some Portuguese cuisine or something to try and celebrate it. Right now, though, it is what? 12:49, and it's Friday, so it's time for this.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Perrier Awards.
See, they've all forgotten to do it. It's not happening. What's going on?
Everyone used to wave when Martha was here.
I know. There's no. Oh, there we go. No, a bit late. A bit late to the fair. No, there we are. That's better. But people forget, you see.
People do forget.
Because you haven't been here for a long time.
Oh, I know.
Not always your fault, I have to say. But we've only managed to get one Perrier Awards system into the mix, I think, in the last 6 weeks.
That's shocking. I do take responsibility.
Yes, you should take full responsibility. Like Sir Keir Starmer.
Yes.
Go and fire somebody.
I will.
Angela Rayner, maybe.
Well, maybe.
So anyway, welcome.
Welcome. Back. Thank you.
Not at all. Nice to see you.
Yes, you too.
I almost forgot what you look like.
Well, you did forget my name the other day.
I pretended to forget your name. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't know who you were.
Well, that's it. That's
anyway, so what have you got for us?
So this is a Perrier Award.
Yes.
So-called Independent Republic of Mike Graham.
So-called.
Where we choose our favourite moments. Mm. So following tradition, the first Perrier Award goes to you.
Excellent.
For the social media technicality of the week.
I've just randomly called somebody on Instagram by mistake. I don't know why I've done it, but I've now just cut them off, whoever they are. So if you got a random call from me, it was a mistake. I'm very sorry about it, and I don't know why it happened. I'll try not to make it happen again. Also, the worst thing about doing it is I never call anyone on Instagram, so I didn't realise that it doesn't cut off. You have to actually physically cut it off. You can't just go click and it goes, you know, it was ringing out.
I didn't know you could call
on
Instagram.
Well, I'm not even sure
Instagram.
I knew you could, but anyway, yeah.
Do you know who you called?
I called somebody who has asked to follow me who I don't know.
Well, maybe you made their day.
Maybe. I haven't run back on for fear of what might be the repercussions.
Oh my goodness. Well,
I'm staying away from it now.
If you were called by Mike Graham on Instagram, give us a call.
Yes, but not on Instagram.
You know the number.
Don't call me back. I'll have to block you.
Oh no. So the Maybank holiday came and went, and this is the Perrier Award for the statement of the week.
How about this from Andy about Bank Holiday Monday? My girlfriend used to work for the bank 30 or so years ago, maybe more. Bank holidays were where to get staff out of the building so they could all be investigated for fraud. I'd forgotten about that one.
Yes.
I'm sure that's not true.
Well,
could it be true?
I don't know. I mean,
seems a bit unfair, doesn't it? Have a day off so we can find out whether you've done anything wrong so we can fire you.
God. Well, I mean, yeah, who were they employing at the end of the day, if that's the case?
Well, you do wonder, don't you?
Mm. So over to the breakfast show for where Dal Babu makes his visual perrier of the week.
Because of the delays in the court system. Then, can you? Does it really matter?
He sneezed.
Oops. That's never a good look, is it?
No, it's not a good look. So sorry, yes, for the people on... For people on YouTube, could see that one.
That's very good. Well done.
So back to the Independent Republic. Speaking to our weekly regular, Tonya Buxton, you estimated the number of COVID variants. This is for the underestimation of the week.
But do you know how many variants we've had so far of COVID in this
About
country?
About five, isn't it?
No, it's 300,000.
Oh, really?
300,000 variants.
Yeah. Don't give me any long five. Books to read. Well, I mean, technically speaking, we've only had five that have actually been named.
Yes.
That was kind of what I was getting at.
Yeah, like the Brazilian, Indian. Yeah,
exactly.
South African.
South African,
Kent. That's it.
There you go. Indian.
Yeah.
So it's about five.
Okay.
I wasn't wrong.
Five main ones.
Yes.
Main ones.
Thanks, Tonya.
Cheers, Tonya.
She's got any more kind of, man traps when she comes back next week?
Oh, gosh. Well, we'll have to wait and find out.
We'll see.
So presenter Kevin O'Sullivan makes the Perry Awards this week for forgetting the station he works on. This is the wrong namer of the week.
This is the home and the zone of free speech and common sense. You know what it's called. Tom Radio.
What's wrong with him?
Tom Radio.
Dear me.
Well, thanks everybody.
Do you know
his phone
doesn't
in.
Work very well either?
His what? His phone.
His phone. Yeah.
Does he?
It goes off randomly apparently because it's got some kind of weird lighting sensitivity, and it goes dark every now and again when he's got it out in front of him.
Oh, okay. It might adjust to the sunlight or
something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. He keeps going off though when he needs it on and he's like waving it about trying to get it to start up again. So hilarious.
Oh no, Kev, get that started.
Come on, Kev.
So another strange noise coming from Ian's show. I wonder what this is.
Mm.
Peter, how are you?
Hi. Good to speak again, Ian.
Hey, you too.
Peter doesn't sound too good.
No. Oh dear.
Hope he's all right.
And finally, this is a late addition, but thank you anyway, Angela.
Okay.
Our favourite royal biographer has earned herself a Perrier for the wrong century of the week.
In Kensington Palace in 1917, he was going out with Meghan, but they weren't engaged. And
You mean 2017, I see. Right. 2017.
Did Meghan... 2017, yes. Sorry,
Yeah, just as well she didn't interview them during the First World War.
Well, yes.
That would have been a different prince, I think.
It would have.
Prince Albert, probably. Or maybe he was dead by then.
Maybe.
Was he?
Queen
Victoria died in 1901.
Right.
I think.
Oh.
So Albert, I think, died before that. So it wouldn't be him. I don't know which prince.
Can I ask a friend on this?
You can,
phone a friend.
About five princes between the two of those.
Oh, my word.
Anyway,
well,
there we are.
Go. Well,
is that it then?
That was the Perry Awards. There will be more next week.
The Perrier Awards on Talk Radio.
Talk Radio. Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday, on Talk Radio via DAB, online, or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.